Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it is really exciting for us in all kinds of unpleasant ways.
And sometimes pleasant ways. And,
well, it has to be net pleasant or we wouldn't do it. Pure economics says...
we need an incentive in there somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't pay KTEM to do the show. Neither do they pay us. So I'm not sure. I guess we're volunteers or something like that. But we're here. And you can certainly ask us questions. Jeff, and that's who is speaking, is a certified financial planner. I'm supposed to say certificate or something
practitioner
silly.
Practitioner
something
or something like that.
And Jake is a...
I hold a designation of Certified Investment Management Analyst.
Yes, he's really analyst. He's an analyst.
I think you could say that about both of us. We're very, very, very analytical.
Yes, we're very analytical, yes. But we spend our week and our weekends and most of our waking hours studying the economy and reading about it and researching it and going back to the original, to the best of our ability, going back to the original figures. It is a delightful thing. I wanted to put a plug in here.
Is it like a Glade plug-in for air freshener?
It could be. Okay. It could be for a lot of people. If you really, a lot of people like to be upset about the economy, and a lot of people like to be upset about the role of government, and a lot of people like to be upset about things. If you're not one of those persons who just really enjoys griping, and you really want to know what's going on, I want to make a recommendation to you. Get a subscription to The Economist magazine and read the darn thing. Now, that's going to take some work because the print's small. The language assumes that you have some reasonable education and are willing to learn. And the articles are not sound bites. They're long. It's almost irritating. My attention span seems to have shrunk with the length of articles that I read. And they make the Wall Street Journal articles look very, very short. But if you read those articles... The reason they're long is because the questions they address are complex questions. The current edition, for example, of The Economist, the danger, the peril of falling inflation. It's exactly what we've been talking about. How
they don't even want to use the word deflation here.
The point is that we're not technically in deflation, although we're on the verge of it in some areas of the economy are in it. What we do have is a persistent and stubborn very low inflation rate, and this is the thing that is worrisome to the Fed. And this week, Janet Yellen was testifying before the Senate for her confirmation, and that's one of the things she talked about. And I think it was very important. She says that inflation continues to fall. The Federal Reserve has a target inflation rate of 2%, and it's down to 1 point something now and falling. With each, and what we've seen, the latest reports were a little scary, as a matter of fact. If you actually look at the prices year over year that the Bureau of Economic Analysis just reported, and it's like the inflation rate is like 0.49% if you take out the highly volatile areas. If you look at the recent rates, you discover they're negative. Now, that... Folks, I know that sounds a little strange. Why am I concerned about the fact that prices are falling? Well, we talked about that. That is a danger. A falling set of prices results in a recession. As far as I can tell in history, without exception. If they fall substantially, you get a depression, and it tends to go into a spiral. And unfortunately, the tail end of depressions tends to be major wars. Anyway.
Yes, a lot of times people hear economists talking about inventory levels, and when inventory levels fall, we say, okay, there's issues here, because if for instance you have a warehouse and you're selling things out of the warehouse and you order new things because that item that you just sold was selling very fast, so you order more stuff. If that thing stops selling as fast, well, then you stop buying more of it from the supplier, and your supplies slowly go down. Well, you're not replenishing. Then they go back to the supplier and they say, it's not selling as fast. You need to give us a better price on it. So all of this, from one end to the other, from every time you go to the store and you see a smaller price, a lower price on any item, you have to recognize that somewhere further along the line, they have to figure out better ways of making that item to keep up mm-hmm. with a dropping price. And sometimes the only thing they can do is say, we're going to have to pay the people that make it less money. Which is why we go to China to make some of our items now, because there's an expectation that yeah. prices are going to be lower and we can't afford to do it in certain circumstances.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
You always shock me when you say that.
The whole gentleman thing is a little scary.
Yeah, I had a little surgery Thursday, which altered the circumstances of my normal weekly life, and I had the opportunity to watch PBS NewsHour last night, something I think Jake might be familiar with. Anyway, there's a fellow named Mark Shields, a lib from start to finish, and he made a comment that surprised me, and I've been thinking about since then. His comment was that he is concerned greatly that the Affordable Care Act and its consequences mark the end of what he called liberal government, which I think he means expansive government. And I'd be curious to see your reaction, to hear your reaction to that comment.
That's a good statement.
I don't know. Actually, I don't see that. I'm kind of lost there. Mark Shields is a sort of an interesting guy. He's a political columnist.
Yep.
He's not an economist.
Yep.
And very frankly, as soon as I see that someone is a political columnist, I am quite comfortable in a very short period of time that whatever they say is not at all what they mean. It is designed to evoke a response from somebody else.
It did. The reason I guess maybe the way I've been thinking about it since I heard that. Y'all are historians. I think of myself as a historian. We recognize there is a cyclical nature to human beings. And I'm wondering if this might mark the end of the pendulum swing to the left.
If Mark Shields said it, I would have a tendency to be very concerned that the opposite was about to happen.
My two cents on this.
You know how much I like him, obviously.
Yeah.
My two cents on this. It may be part of a pendulum swing. If the exchange website, the Federal Exchange, not Federal Exchange, but the
Healthcare Exchange.
Healthcare Exchange on the federal site is not fixed in a relatively quick manner, there's going to be a shift in the Senate and there's going to be a shift in the House. That's going to cause political ramifications to the party that's considered to be liberal. It seems like every time there's a big election like that, though, they say this is the end of the Republicans or mm-hmm. this is the end of the Democrats.
For whatever it's worth, the best way to – looking at Obamacare and the rollout from a strictly neutral point of view, it's like when Windows first came out. It was so buggy. It was such a mess that if you were following software at the time, and we were because we were busy getting it, the programming community, the users, everybody howled in dismay. That didn't mean that Microsoft was about to fail and stop growing, though. And I frankly think that there is a high probability that a year from now we'll look back at Obamacare as a nation and say, seems to be working pretty well. Now, I could be completely wrong there, but let me simply say that I have dug deeply into this thing recently and found out some of the things that are going on behind the scenes that are not making the headlines that are already having impact. If I could throw one other thing in. United Healthcare laid off 3,700 doctors last month. Are you aware of that?
Yep.
The reason they laid them off is because their scoring was below standard. They were charging too much, their patients were unhappy, and their outcomes were poor. And I'm very familiar with this scoring system because a member of my family works at a hospital and is subject to the same scoring system. I think that there's a lot of positive things going on behind the scene that have nothing to do with the overt, obvious things, including the stupidity, frankly, the idiocy of the president saying that you can keep your health care when, in fact, you couldn't, and the fact that in July, the people who were tasked with making the website work were saying it ain't going to work in time. And the government and the administration ignoring it. I think those are abysmal. I think they're terrible. And I think it is a short setback. On the other hand, I also recognize that across the country, the cost of health care per patient for the last year has finally leveled off. And the alternative was they would all blow up. By the way, Mark Shields, as far as I'm concerned, he's completely wrong because exactly the same comments came out after the implementation of Social Security, after the implementations of Medicare. So it's going to continue to be a battle going forward. Don't think the government is about to stop expanding.
Yeah. That's going to take checks and balances from the voters, and that's a constant set of voting requirements.
Yeah, try to get on an airplane and tell me government has an
I do want to point out something. You said something that a year from now we'll look back at Obamacare, and I think what tends to happen – well, I think that the gist of what you're saying is correct. I think what tends to happen is a year from now, if it's working, we won't look back on it. It will just be part of society.
This is my point. I think we will look back. Let me tell you the reason I say that, caller. I'm not saying it because I like or dislike anything. I'm saying it because whatever the current crisis is, whatever the thing is we're most worried and upset about it today, typically about a year from now, will be fixed. It's the thing that we're not, whatever it is, I don't know what it is, whatever we're not worried about today, whatever we think is going to run smoothly today, that's going to bite us a year from now. I mean, the nation was convinced in 2007 that mortgage securities seemed to be the greatest things in the world.
Yeah, AAA rated, it was backed by collateral. I mean, how could this be bad?
And yet that's what bit us. Right now, by the way, if you want to know something I think is going to bite us, I'm going to say this publicly again. It's the life insurance companies. They're unregulated.
Well, unregulated at a federal level.
They're federally unregulated. And they operate nationwide and globally, but they're only regulated by one state, typically.
At a time, yes.
Just like the banks were in 1929 through 34, they're regulated state by state. It wasn't a true federal regulator. Just like the investment banks weren't regulated in the 2008-2009 crisis. And they were the cornerstone of the last crisis. Now, nobody seems to be worried about that. Matter of fact, I'm having to counter people all the time who want to take all their money out of the stock market and give it to an annuity company, a life insurance company, to get security and safety and a guarantee. Well, that's taking all their money and investing in a single stock company.
Yeah,
which
is a genuinely bad idea.
But that's what people are doing. And so there seems to be this consistency. And I'm in a program with a bunch of other professional financial planners, education program. And when they turn in papers, they're all the school book solution is stick a big fat fixed annuity in the middle of your financial plan, and that way you have this guaranteed stability, you know.
Except
there's no guarantee.
And I have pointed out in my critique of other people's papers, hey, you know, the company, well, I'll just use the name of the company, John Hancock. It's owned by a penny stock company in Canada.
Yep.
And yet they offer the highest interest rates. I mean, these are professionals. So that's the thing. You want to know something I think is going to bite us is that one. And, of course, that will mean an expansion of government, federal government, to regulate the insurance industry, which I frankly think we need.
This is something that we get a lot of because we talk about this sort of things. Areas that are completely unregulated federally that need regulations. People think that we're for expanding government, which is exactly the opposite of what we said just a moment ago. But if you look at, for instance, here's a great example, Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid used to go all over the place robbing stagecoaches and trains, and then he'd just go back to New Mexico.
Banks, yes.
He'd go back to New Mexico, and he just wouldn't rob any banks, stagecoaches, or trains in New Mexico. And there wasn't anybody that would cross the state line to go and arrest him. They had to hire the Pinkertons to come get him, a private organization, because we didn't have any method of regulating across state lines. And one of the things that's come up is very important in Obamacare is that while per patient costs look like they're going to be going down, actually, in the next couple of years, per patient costs for medical treatment. Let me be very clear there. Insurance rates may go up during that same time period. Now, that can't continue, and this is the thing. Medical costs were not the thing that was regulated in Obamacare.
Right.
But the impact of Obamacare is going to have lasting effects on healthcare costs. What it isn't addressing, and one of the things that I think is massively, I said this last year, I have a solution that would fix a big chunk of this, and at the state level. If every state, which is pretty much impossible, but it's happened in the past, if every state would pass substantially the same legislation regulating insurance companies the way they did from the 19-teens all the way up into the 1950s, every single state in the United States has almost identical laws covering securities trading. If we could do that in the insurance world, then all of this extra stuff that's being laid on by the federal government would be over the top, way over the top. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah,
I look at that and I say there's an easy solution if people can work together, but I don't see that happening.
To give a little balance here, I personally think the Department of Homeland Security has got to be one of the worst mistakes. you know, we didn't need a new department.
Yeah.
And
I'm interested in your reaction because it's not diametrically different from mine, but I had a substantially different reaction to that remark.
Well, he made that. You got to understand that whenever Mr. Shields makes a remark like that, it is designed to elicit a response from the people who oppose him.
Right.
And whatever your native response is what he was trying to achieve.
If he says, as a liberal, if he says, oh, the liberals are done, that's going to put the conservatives, oh, yeah, we did it. We don't have to push any harder.
No, that's not my my reaction was, if I can capture it properly, I hope he's right.
Well,
I hope the pendulum has.
If he believed that, he would never say it.
That's an interesting.
Because he is, his constituency is somewhat to the left of Karl Marx. And he wants to, A, please his constituency, and B, tick off the people who are not in his constituency. That's his job.
Yep.
And so if he said something that you consider to be favorable, consider that he probably was clearly stating something he didn't believe with the intent of getting some reaction. Figure out what the reaction is he wants and go in the other direction, and you'll probably be right on the truth someplace.
And if you think of it also from the perspective of a liberal listener, what is, I mean, there's some things synonymous in a liberal culture.
He's trying to fire up the liberal base.
And the liberal base, the extreme liberals, are all about activism.
Yep.
And if they're told this is failing, what do? They go out and have sit-ins. They get this. This is the thing that draws the liberals together.
Yeah, that's it.
You tell that to the liberals, and you're saying the same thing to the conservatives, and conservatives are like, all right, you just told us we won. Yay, we don't have to work any harder.
Think about Rush Limbaugh for just a moment. He has an agenda, and he is always telling us that the era of free enterprise and freedom
is at an end.
Is coming to an end unless we act rigorously
right now, right? That's what's happening.
Not the way I'd characterize it, but I understand what.
Well, I mean, that's a generalized. He's always warning about the end of freedom and capitalism. And you just had a liberal guy get on there and warn about the end of big government liberalism. Yeah, sure. No, as a matter of fact, the fact that he said that concerns me for the opposite.
This is fascinating to me because we get a lot of flack. I've read Ayn Rand. She is one of, I really enjoy reading Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead and these great books. These are, and they purport this kind of very, well, not kind of, extremely laissez-faire, let the government be completely out of the regulatory environment and just let people do capitalism. And I've also read Karl Marx, which is the opposite. And this is fascinating to me. I'm just as much a fan of the ideas that Karl Marx wrote, because it was out of pure integrity that he wrote it, just like Ayn Rand did. But they're extreme opposites. One side says no regulation. One side says only regulation. You mm-hmm. must regulate everything.
And we got some very fascinating experiments going
right.
on here.
Right, and when you have absolutes like that, and you don't take into account that the real world is somewhere in the middle.
And by the way, there's three wonderful experiments going on in the world right now. The Europeans are trying austerity.
Right.
They're trying, and this is, the irony here is phenomenal. The Europeans economically are trying to do precisely what the Tea Party wants to do here. The Europeans.
From a socialist standpoint.
European central whatever, okay? Bank and the community.
Well, some of Europe. France is trying to tax the crazies out.
My point is that they're making everybody be austere and cut their spending whether they
right.
want to or not.
Right.
No matter what it does, cut the spending, that'll solve the problem. By the way, it's not working very
That's
well.
That's deflationary again.
And in China, they're saying flood everything with money.
That's inflationary.
But cut social spending to nothing.
That's deflationary.
And here in the United States, we're trying to find a middle road. We're trying to find something that somehow works running down the middle, and we're butting heads with each other about it, which, by the way, I think is, in as much as it irritates the heck out of me, is probably extremely healthy.
Yeah, when we look at...
I agree.
True.
And yes. That's what I love about America is we don't speak with a single voice, and it drives the rest of the world crazy. But somehow, in the midst of all of our head-butting and calling each other idiots and extremism and protests and shutting down the government, everything else, our system works better than any of those other systems.
I am stuck here in the fact that I am not registered Republican and I am not registered Democrat, and nor would I want to be at any time in the foreseeable future.
So you have, in Texas, you have exited the political system.
Right. And what that means is that I don't get to vote in the primaries, which are actually the only place that you have an impact on who's going to be elected anymore. The end result of this is you might think that I abhor the two-party system, but when I look around at France, which has 14 political parties, and I watch them just destroy each other and not doing anything, I don't see that that is any better than the two. I think it's worse. I think it's worse than a two-party system, because those parties all are, it's the same political structure, just with a lot less mm-hmm. control, a lot less focus. When we actually do get some focus, which we have not seen in the last 5 years or so in our government, we have a tendency of doing some pretty amazing things. I think if I had priorities for myself and I in the governmental way, and I laid them out, I think they would be very similar to most conservatives and most liberals. I think we should simplify the tax code. I think we should simplify the regulatory code of insurance. Basically, these are the same things that are being stated on both sides, but they're arguing about. If we don't simplify the tax code, I mean, I'm thinking of the amount of money that's disappearing in our system that isn't going towards taxes and it isn't going towards spending. It's going towards figuring out how to pay our taxes.
Yeah, and whether or not we violated the law.
Right, and the reality, and this happens every year, people take their tax, these news organizations, they take the same taxes to multiple filing locations, different organizations with accountants. And even the simple taxes, not on one sheet, but in many other cases where you just got some deductibles that can be taken. These deductions are coming out. They get a different tax owed at each of the different accounting firms that they go to.
Yep.
Okay.
That's a problem.
Thanks for your call. You always have good. You always have good
thanks
calls.
For the call. Yeah.
You keep accusing us of being gentlemen. Thank you very much. Okay.
Eventually, we might begin to resemble that remark.
I hope whatever it was that you went and got fixed stays fixed,
yes.
And you get well soon. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
Right. you know, our you know, when we only have about five listeners, it's really we could have a 20%. You know, if something happened to him, we could have we'd have a 20% drop in our listening.
If we actually started listening to our own program, we might double the ratings.
That would be really amazing. Cool. Hey, I wanted to give you some good news. You probably already knew.
What's that?
There's a headline in the Wall Street Journal. I think it's in the Wall Street Journal. Yes. Hitting the brake on ethanol. Government proposes easing level of corn-based additive required in gasoline. Thank God.
Yes. Agreed.
And you know, you would think it would be a left-wing liberal who insisted on mandating that we put 10% of, we make 10% of gasoline ethanol made from corn. So that farmers could have more. I mean, I don't know what the heck. The reason is theoretically energy. There's two things. There's two stories.
Energy independence.
There's two stories here. One, the United States cannot produce enough ethanol to meet the congressional requirement to put that much in the fuel. We just simply we're not capable of doing it. The reason is that people actually want to eat corn.
Yeah, we do eventually want to eat some of it.
And we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year providing subsidies to corn growers and purchasing the corn at weird rates for the purpose of putting it in. And this is the funny thing. It takes more fuel to produce ethanol than the 10% it saves in gasoline. Now, that was a George Bush initiative. It was wonderful. It helped capture presidential primaries in Iowa, but it is silly, it is wrong, and I'm really glad to see it. Now, the other thing, for the first time in 20 years, something happened last month.
Can I hit ethanol here real quick?
Okay.
Because there's another story, and hold that.
It's tied right to it.
Okay. You hit that, and I'll come back to the ethanol.
For the first time, we produced more oil than we imported. Now, that doesn't mean that we have a net positive yet, but the actual oil production in the United States exceeded the imports for the first time in 20 years, and the, I think it was the World Bank, said by 2035, it's pretty clear if we continue on the same track, the United States will be energy independent.
I think that is... It's been a goal for a long time. I think that's an excellent, excellent piece of news. As far as ethanol goes, this is funny because when we look at it from the terms of economics and the spreading ripples of this law that required 10% ethanol per gallon of gasoline, it led to civil war in Syria and Libya and Egypt and Northern Africa falling apart. It's leading to further violence in Iraq and Iran. And people are probably wondering where I'm going with this. And I don't just mean that oil changed prices. I mean, we had tortilla riots in Mexico City 2 years after the ethanol law went into effect, because white corn is what you make ethanol out of, and white corn is what is used to create tortillas, and tortilla prices doubled in Mexico, which caused riots in the streets because that's a staple of their food. It caused exports of corn, which was a supplemental staple in Northern Africa, to drop drastically because we were using that corn to create ethanol, which caused wheat prices to go up. Because there was less corn, people used more wheat, there was the same amount of wheat, and then Russia had a horrible harvest, and they had just passed us up as the number one wheat producers. Well, the reason why they passed us up as the number one wheat producers as a country is because we put more fields in corn than we'd had in wheat before, even fields that aren't supposed to grow corn, that don't have the right balance in the soil, that we're destroying the soil to grow corn. So Russia has a bad crop of wheat, and then they had big rains come in, and Russia said, we're not exporting any wheat, zero. They made a governmental decision that said no wheat. So they had bread riots in Northern Africa, and if you look back to the first guy in Tunisia that lit himself on fire, it was a bread merchant. And if you look at the original Arab Spring marches – They had rolls of bread strapped to their head. That's the reason why the Arab Spring happened, is because prices of food went up based on an ethanol tax. Basically, we're subsidizing ethanol to be in there. Anyway, those are the ripples that happen from when we do something that we think is going to affect the economy, or we're going to affect, oh, this is a green initiative, and that ethanol is not a fossil fuel, so we won't be running out of it. But the reality is that we're creating more carbon, from every area that I can look at it. And unless you're a corn farmer, this was a bad thing. If you're a corn farmer, it's a good thing.
We got a break for commercials, though. If you don't object.
I don't object.
Okay, so we're going to break for some commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a telephone call on 866-597-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, excuse me. Hey, this is John in Round Rock.
Hello, John von Round Rock.
Yeah, you got more than five listeners, I think.
you would be number six?
Yes. Our ratings actually say that it's somewhere in the very high numbers, but the number of callers that we have are pretty regularly the same people.
I see. Well, you know, I wish you were on a few more stations or had a little more power there. You know, your comments about the ethanol leading to food riots makes a lot of sense, and I've seen stuff somewhere before about that, but it's not that public, not that well known.
Yeah, and it isn't well known, and that's unfortunate, because this is my objection to the news media, but there's nothing we can do about it. News competition is so intense right now with the blogs and the Drudge Report and everything else, and the main media having to keep up with it. It's very hard for them to get a decent story out. Earlier, and I'm going to say this again, earlier I recommended to anyone who really wants to understand what the heck is going on in the world, get a subscription to The Economist magazine.
I agree.
They explain this in great detail. It's just that people's, for lack of a better term, I think most people don't have an attention span long enough to read an article in The Economist.
Right. I think when we're talking about news, because it's a 24-hour cycle and because people have short attention spans, and we want to see it on Twitter or we want to watch a three-minute something on what's going on in the world, we're missing anything of depth. We're missing the fact that when the U.S. government makes a change to an economy, whether it's ethanol or insurance or whatever, there are going to be ripples that take place for years, and some of them don't look anything like what the first domino falling was.
We live in a very complex world, so you can't listen to sound bites and understand what the heck is going on. Unfortunately, there is a populist movement in the nation, which occurs about once a 100 years right now. It's occurring where we think that complex issues can be solved with simple solutions.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's not true.
I have a very, very intelligent friend who thinks that pure democracy is the only way to go forward. And most people think we live in a democracy, and that's not the case. We live in a representative democracy. That's a republic. Mm-hmm. He thinks that we should crowdfund or crowdsource all of the problems so that everybody just can come in all at once and make a vote on each law that's being passed. And that, to me, is utterly terrifying, because I know the people that do that kind of voting. And I know even the smart people that come on it with that short attention span, and they think, well, this is very easy. We get that with people whose whole job and who have huge staffs of people that are working for them, who their whole job is to try to figure out what are the things that might go wrong if we do this.
Let me give an example
here? Sure, yeah.
There's an article right now in the Wall Street Journal. It's dated actually November 13th. The headline is, aggressive enforcement may drive out college-educated immigrants.
Yep.
Now, it's really fascinating. This is the Wall Street Journal. It's owned by the same people, the same guy that owns Fox, that tends to leans to the right pretty hard. And they're reporting, very accurately, by the way, that the states that have had serious attempts at enforcing anti-illegal immigrant laws have not lowered, and this is amazing, the number of illegal immigrants in those states hasn't budged. But the legal immigrants who have college educations are leaving those states in droves. And so the simple solution of let's enforce the law, they're breaking the law, for instance, in Arizona, has not apparently affected the number of illegal immigrants in the state at all. But it has done a really, really, really good job of removing legal immigrants with college educations from the state of Arizona.
They don't feel welcome.
So a simple solution, almost inevitably, results in unanticipated consequences that just don't work. We had a dependence on foreign oil. Price of oil was going up. George Bush initiated, and it was a Republican-initiated idea to turn corn into fuel, put it into automobiles, and thereby move us towards energy independence. So the government was getting involved in the marketplace to do this. In fact, what has moved us towards energy independence is the fact that the price of oil went up and it became economically feasible
to figure out how to do fracking.
For oil companies to put a lot of R&D money in figuring out how to get to the oil they knew was there.
Yeah, this is the case when we're talking about renewable fuel sources, too. If we have renewable fuel that is solar or wind or wave or any of the other renewable fuel sources, as long as the subsidies are going into it from the government, as long as we are putting so much money into getting those things up and running, no money is being put, or not a lot of money is being put, towards research and development to bring the cost of those technologies down, because they don't have to. We're using the same wind turbines today that we were 15 years ago. The same huge turbines, and they're being made in Westinghouse in Round Rock. These huge turbines are being made, and they're the same turbines that were being made there 10 years ago. There has been some slight technological innovation, but they don't need to have technological innovation. They know it's not profitable to do it, but the subsidies make it profitable. Mm-hmm. They don't have to invest in R&D to get a better turbine, and there are better ideas out there, but there's no funding for the ideas to bring the cost down so that it's competitive with non-renewable resources.
There's places where the government needs to be and places where the government doesn't need to be, and there's some pretty, if you ask any serious economist I'm not talking about somebody who's just a hack. I'm talking about the high level economists,
not political, actual economists.
They can tell you the rules and the circumstances under which the government should step in and regulate. But the idea of the government trying to get out ahead of the market and choose technologies and support them for other than, and I want to emphasize something, for other than defense.
Correct.
Has inevitably been a massive failure and waste of time and money.
And the reason for this is pretty obvious. If you jump in and you say, what is it that the government is supposed to do for us? Well, they're supposed to defend us. They don't want us forming our own army to defend ourselves. They don't want that. That's bad. We've all agreed we are the government. Mm-hmm. We don't want our neighbor to own 5 tanks and a nuclear weapon.
We don't.
Evidently, the votes are saying that
one of our neighbors
strictly prohibited in
Fort Hood is our neighbor.
Fort Hood is our neighbor. Yes, there are certain areas that is a little extreme. If one person can kill 100,000 people without any,
right.
You know, that's not. We're not going to do that. We can defend ourselves, but no more. But when it comes to the economy, when it comes to the rest of our day-to-day activities, the things that we do a lot better than the government does. As soon as the government says, we are going to, based on our infinite wisdom, we the Congress or I the President are going to bestow millions of dollars on XYZ companies so that they can do something that we perceive as good. As soon as that happens, they become just like CalPERS.
Yeah.
CalPERS has this huge pension fund out of California, and they come into a company, and they vote all the shares of CalPERS. So they'll buy a for-profit company for political reasons, because the people that vote the proxies at CalPERS don't own the shares. They're political appointees. So they can come in and make their political whims in a capitalist world and cause the companies that they're purchasing to go out of business or to not make profits, mm-hmm. which is not good for the pension. Anyway, that's could go on for quite a lot. We've got some more commercials to play.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
And I think we're probably in agreement on that. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
All right.
And we're going to – this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We're going to do some more commercials. Telephone numbers to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We have two callers. The first one we're going to is caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I'm probably your eighth listener out here.
Okay, good. It's nice to know. There's another one over there, too, so maybe we got nine.
This is
today.
Getting difficult. I can't count them on one hand anymore.
Yeah, well, okay.
My question is about precious metals, not about should they be good investments, but historically, gold and silver have had a 16-to-1 ratio of value. Looking at Kitco's prices this morning, I mean, there's a huge imbalance. It's almost like 62-to-1. Why is there such an imbalance between the price of gold and silver? Why are they not at the usual historic 16-to-1?
I've got a easy answer, and I've got a hard answer. We don't have a whole lot of time for the hard answer, so I'm going to give you the easy answer. Technology again. There is an imbalance there because silver has a lot more uses in non-commodity form, in product form, than gold does. And gold is being hoarded. Okay, so you've got outside factors besides just use of the commodity. Technology's coming in because gold prices have been at the height that they were for a long time. Technology has come out to, this is one of my favorite pieces of technology, filter gold out of seawater.
And can I throw something else in here on this direct answer to your question? The 16-to-1, you remember that it was 35-to-1 for many years. There was a dollar was an ounce of gold. And $35 or $32 at different times was an ounce of gold. That was the Bretton Woods Agreement. Anytime that you see this 16-to-1 or 32-to-1 or something like that,
it's artificial.
Those numbers are based on purely artificial government restrictions. There is no historic natural relationship between gold and silver.
It's like saying there's a relationship between pine wood and wheat. There may be in certain areas mm-hmm. where the climate is affected in certain ways, but the reality is that they in nature have a relationship with each other.
We have this wonderful mythology around gold and silver that has no basis in fact. It's governmentally imposed, and it's convenient for governments from time to time to do that. Okay?
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
We may get to that one further next week. That's got a lot more stuff behind it that we could talk about.
And we have another caller on. Whoop.
Yeah, and they're gone.
They hung up.
Well, that's good because we're almost out of time, and we're almost out of time for this hour.
Gold,
for this week.
We've talked about this. Anything that you purchase as an investment in the long run will be measured by its if in a free market system. Will be measured by the utility, which is a word for usefulness, it produces. If I buy Toyota stock, for example, because I think Toyota has been undervalued by the market and they make a better car than everybody else does in these silly lawsuits, when they are silly lawsuits about auto acceleration.
Hypothetical.
Yeah, I'm not recommending Toyota. Have artificially depressed the stock. Well, what we're saying is, I think I'm effectively saying that Toyota has a higher utility than the market recognizes.
Or even in oil, when right. you say this oil has use, it's going to be refined and turned mm-hmm. into fuel at some point. And I look around and I say, all right, the people that are using oil are going to be using more oil. This is, again, hypothetical, because I see people using less oil. They're going to use more oil next year, and supply is limited. So I think oil is going to go up. That has a utility that you can say. Where with gold, the utility is purely, and this is hugely funny to me, It is the same utility as a sports card, a collector's sports card. It is entertainment utility. Mm-hmm. It is to say, I have gold.
And as long as that mythology hangs around, gold will be overpriced. It's overpriced. It's way the heck overpriced. And that's why we generally don't advise people to buy it. Anything that's overpriced is likely to come down. And for the last 650 years, gold has broadly been declining in price with sudden run-ups. But each run-up, when we calculate inflation in and do an equal measurement, each run-up takes it to a lower peak than the previous one. And we don't know when the run-ups and when the collapses are going to occur.
Yeah. In 1982, it's really easy to remember this, that gold was at $820 an ounce.
Which was a lot more buying power than we have today. It was closer, it's pretty much doubled.
Yeah, if you calculate for inflation, that it would have had to get up to right around $2,000 at its peak this time around. Well, the very top of the peak was $1,700.
So it's just one of those things where we do long-term investing, and it's the only one that's been proven to work consistently over the long term. Well, boo, don't you love that? Well, anyway, you've been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We are an SEC-registered fee-only investment advisor. I think we do pretty good work with people's portfolios and take care of people pretty well. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local telephone number which has a voicemail on it during the weekend, answered by a real live human being during the week. 947-1111, or
you can reach it toll-free, same number, same voicemail, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.